Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Excited to be with you this week as we celebrated Valentine's Day, and y'all heard that show last week, but now are moving into new content for this week, and we are excited about that as well. Later on in the show, we're going to be hearing from our own Glenn Stanton as he addresses a question about being at university, being at college, and really having that assumption, as many of you do, we hear from you a lot, that because you maybe have a biblical worldview, you are considered anti a bunch of things. And with this question in particular, it is someone who feels that they're always called anti-gay because of their view of marriage as outlined in the scriptures. So we'll listen in and see what Glenn has to say about that. Then for this week's culture segment, we have the first of two parts of my interview with Tim Gegline, who's our vice president here at Focus on the Family of External Relations. He lives in Washington, D.C. and is in the fray there in the realm of public policy. And he is the author of Man in the Middle, which kind of chronicles his time in the White House with President George W. Bush and all that that entailed, including the ramifications of plagiarism on his part, which led to his departure from the White House and really where God has brought him since then. And now for our roundtable segment, we've got kind of we're looking thematically at this kind of stuff. And today I have members of our Focus Leadership Institute here in the room with me. Very pleased to have you guys. Welcome.
Thanks, Lisa.
Good to be here.
Very fun. And we're going to be talking a little bit again about that voice in the public square. So what does it mean really to when you're in college, when you are faced with having to be winsome with whether it's elements of faith or what you believe? I think a lot of students kind of find themselves in school and all of a sudden they meet up with questions or concerns from other people, or maybe they're what they believe is being challenged, whether in the classroom or even in their social life, and they have to figure out how to grapple with that and how to respond to it. So I want to welcome Lindy Keffer. Lindy, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Very glad to have you. And Chris Vaya, he's here as well.
Hi, Lisa.
And also Dr. Neelan Brown.
Greetings. It's a pleasure.
Very excited to have you. And you are now, Dr. Brown is actually in charge of the Institute.
I am.
He's just taken over. But he's a relative newbie here at Focus on the Family, so we're just kind of getting him, you know, acclimated to the Focus culture.
Getting his feet wet.
Exactly. All the ins and outs, you know, showing him the cafeteria, kind of stuff, making sure he knows what's what. So, but three great colleagues here who, for those of you who know, obviously we talk about the Leadership Institute often here at Boundless, and you can find it at focusleadership.org. But this program has been going on for how long now?
Since 1995.
1995.
It was our first semester fall.
It's about 17 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow, 17 years. So really, students who went through this that first semester are literally out and about in our culture now, probably in leadership positions. I think it's just a great opportunity. And those of you who know Martha know that she went through the Institute as well. And that's why she's so as wonderful as she is today.
Exactly.
Had a huge role in that. But really, it's an opportunity for students to come to take a semester out of their studies, whether they're in college or graduate school to some level there, and really get a foundation for family, worldview, all the ways, you know, leadership issues, really to integrate that into not only their student experience, but then ultimately their experience in the, quote, real world that involves corporate life, whether they choose to serve in public service as they move towards marriage and family, which we're passionate about here at Boundless. So very pleased to have you guys with us and to represent that ministry here. So let's go ahead and just launch straight into this topic, because I want to, you know, here I am. I grew up kind of in that stereotypical little sheltered environment, in a sense, of being in a Christian home and having a relatively conservative family, although I did go to the California public schools. And so I kind of had both worlds going on there. And I often tell people, you know, it's a wonder I survived. I did go through the California public schools through all of my initial schooling. And then I went to a Christian college after that. So for me, it was almost the flip of this. But I think we see a lot of students who kind of grow up in these homes and they're at church and they're in their youth groups and they're just really feeling maybe by the time they hit college that they've had this sheltered existence in a sense. And, you know, they kind of, like I said, lived with their families or had their Christian friends and whatever, listened to their Chris Tomlin and that kind of stuff. And that was kind of their experience. And then they go to college and basically they feel ill prepared, or they're just deer in the headlights for what they encounter there. So the first question I want to ask you guys in light of this is, what do you think, first of all, is this just a great chasm? And what has happened that our students are not prepared? Has there been a shift at the schools, or is there something that's not happening in the homes that's really causing this great divide?
Well, within the context of the university environment, it's a the word university, basically, it's universal. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot, you have a large exchange mm-hmm. of ideas that's mm-hmm. taking place. You have a lot of students who have never really had deep discussion mm-hmm. about what they believe. They've accepted it. It's been ratified in their local church, in their home, so on and so forth. And a lot of the focus oftentimes in the local church is on outreach. Learn the gospel quickly, put it out there. Learn it quickly, put it out there. One of the things that a lot of students bump into when they go to college is they've done a lot of learning about outreach, but they haven't constructed a view of inreach, which means they haven't dealt with themselves as of yet. Mm-hmm. Reminds me of Romans chapter 12, verse 2. The Apostle Paul talks about not being conformed, but being transformed, not conforming to the patterns of this world, but being transformed. And I think a lot of students haven't breathed in the gospel in such a way where they have been transformed by it. So oftentimes they find themselves defending a truth that they haven't fully integrated and accepted into their life at a very, very, very personal level. And when you come into an exchange of ideas, it puts you in a very difficult mm-hmm. situation mm-hmm. because you're defending something you're not even wholly sure
about. It feels disingenuous to the person you're talking with.
Sure.
It makes you defensive. It makes you unattractive because you're kind of throwing things at them instead of expressing something that has deeply transformed you.
They're not trained in the art of conversation and what that looks like for a back and forth exchange of
right.
ideas.
Mm-hmm.
If they've only grown up with people that are just like them and people that have their own ideas, they're never going to have been trained in how to defend what they believe because they've never had to before.
Yeah. Right. So it sounds like really it's both an inner work that needs to happen as well as just some skills in how to apply that. Because really,
exactly.
I mean, I look at my own experience and it was a lot of being under my parents' spiritual shadow, going to church with my parents, understanding what I believed in the context of that. But really, I think what I felt I was doing as a high schooler especially was managing my behavior, managing my sin, managing
sure.
my environment
yeah.
to the point where, okay, so then I just tried to like not encounter those kinds of things.
Right.
But that's not reality when people get to school.
And they'll become exposed with it. Even if they go to a Christian school,
mm-hmm.
they'll be exposed to all different sorts of ideas and ways of living and that they never have had to before. And we were talking about this yesterday, too. The idea of civil discourse mm-hmm. in this country is pretty much non-existent anymore.
Mm-hmm.
People just shout at the top of their lungs, and if you don't hear them, then they'll just shout louder.
Mm-hmm.
And so the exchange of ideas that was common maybe even 5 or 6 years ago really isn't around anymore, which creates, and I'm sure your listeners have felt that whether they're on a Christian college campus or a secular university,
mm-hmm.
That they don't feel like there's an ability, even if they knew how to have a conversation,
yeah.
that the ears aren't able to listen anymore.
In other words, nobody's good at it. It's not like we have Christian kids and they're the only ones that are bad at talking about what they believe or speaking to people who believe differently. Nobody in our culture is good at it. We either yell at the people who believe differently or we only spend time around people who believe the same. And so it's kind of like two people who've come into a marriage from families with really bad communication skills, and you try to communicate with each other and it's mm-hmm. it's train wreck.
It's not a good idea.
That's kind of what's going on in our culture all the time right now.
Okay, so why is it then that it seems, and does it just seem this way, or does it seem like, and I'm just going to say it, that those with an anti-Christian bent, those who are diametrically opposed to our worldview, why does it seem that all their arguments are cogent then? Why does it seem like they're bringing their A game to the table? And then I want to also address, and maybe you guys can launch into this a little bit, what are some of these actual attacks? What are the core things that are being attacked when students have to basically put up or shut up when they show up at school and it's like, okay, we're going to start talking about this, 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 and then deer in the headlights, what's being attacked? And then why does it always seem like everyone else has really the benefit of whether it's social media or just the means of communicating these things?
I would say the reason that the liberals or the non-Christians are seem to be bringing their A game is that they are shouting tolerance, tolerance, tolerance at the top of their lungs. And I think if you, it's a very thin veil of intolerance, but they are given the benefit of the doubt, whereas Christians have been labeled as the ones who are judging and aren't able to communicate their ideas effectively and speak that truth and love that Jesus calls us to.
I might have to disagree with you because I don't know that I hear really well-formed arguments anywhere in the culture. I do think you're right that there seems to be this, oh, you're a Christian, so you're not allowed to have an opinion here, or we don't want to hear your opinion. But I don't think it's because those who disagree with us have a very well-reasoned or well-formed answer or well-formed argument against us. I think it's just more this cultural assumption that, oh, that's not okay. Anyone who believes that there is a truth, we don't want to hear them. It's not okay to hold that belief. It's okay to have any other kind of ill-formed, not very well put together, doesn't make sense, isn't coherent kind of belief system, as long as you don't believe that there is a truth revealed by God that we can know.
Mm-hmm. I think the truth of the gospel is not often applauded in the public forum, and you cannot judge truth by the amount of applause that you hear. I have students who have in the university setting who've been atheists and students who've been Christians. None of them have deeply dealt with what they're arguing for. Does that make sense? So that isn't, I wouldn't say that the issue of deep internal thought and transformation isn't only on the side of the Christian student. A lot of the students that I talk to, well, I'm a de facto atheist. Okay, why are you a de facto atheist? Because I read this book. Okay, there were 10 other books on that same shelf. Did you engage those? Well, no, because this is who I am. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So we're a very surfacey culture. And we pick the winner not based upon, you know, not based upon truth and validity. We pick the winner based upon applause. Mm-hmm. And so in a world, in a society that is largely moving away from the truth of the gospel, moving away from biblical tenets, louder applause is always going to rest on that side of things. Mm-hmm. That's why students need to be transformed so they understand truth is not about a popularity contest.
Exactly.
It's not about winning the moment and saying, ooh, I won. And it's not necessarily, the Bible is very clear about seed time and harvest. And I tell my students all the time, you don't reap every time you sow. Sometimes you plant the gospel, that other person has much more to say. But here's the question, did you plant a good seed? It's not about who yelled louder, who said more words, you know, who quoted more books. It's about truth. You can, my grandmother, Big Mama, we called her. It didn't take Big Mama a whole lot of words to say something profound. Big Mama could cut to the core of you with four words. And I've heard a lot of intellectuals pontificate and stand on podiums and say nothing that compares to my Big Mama. Does that make sense? Big Mama didn't need all those words because she spoke truth, and truth isn't doesn't have to have all of this good stuff with it. Everyone doesn't have to applaud what Big Mama said, but we know this. Big Mama's life, the transformation in it, spoke for her. And I think to impact this culture, which is very shallow, very surfacey, again, it's about who yells the loudest and who quotes the most recent book of whatever position they have. Oftentimes, Christian leaders will find themselves not garnering the most applause in the public forum, but that does not render their truth invalid.
Well, and that's what it seems that is that really, I mean, what strikes me right there is that Big Mama probably resonated with people because it's so rare that we hear that kind of truth spoken boldly, succinctly, just putting it out. I mean, we're so often trying to dance around what we're trying to say. And really, I mean, I see almost, Neil, and what you were saying is where the other side, where those who are hostile to the gospel are winning is in the marketing campaign. It's like they're trying to market truth. So, for example, they have all of a sudden made Christians be anti-everything. We're anti-women. We're anti, you know, and it's like they've taken over the language and made it their own, and then we get stuck on the defensive. And I think that's where Christians, you know, and so many younger people feel like, oh, we're fighting on the losing side because we don't have the right words, or we don't have the flashy campaigns, or we don't have these massive social media machines behind us, when really we need to forget about that and stick to the truth.
We've really, and I think we've accepted a definition of what winning is. That we need to revisit. Winning isn't necessarily having the best marketing campaign.
And or moving, the most likes on Facebook.
Or the most likes on Facebook. Jesus was always about the individual, the life and the impact and the formation upon that individual. And with that said, as we move out into culture, we can't look for the likes on Facebook. We have to, have genuine community, which is something that is now becoming extinct. But mm-hmm. we have to really seek genuine community, genuine partnership, genuine relationship in the grocery store. Mm-hmm. That's where we win as Christian leaders, not necessarily, you know, in the popularity contest per se.
Mm-hmm. So let me tell you a story. To go along with what Neelan just said, we have a student who was here in the fall of 2010, and we were talking about, okay, what are you doing to be just winsome in culture? What are you doing to present the gospel in not a shouting match way, but in a real, here's how my life was transformed way? And so I have a student who said, okay, well, here's my story. My last semester of college, I was working the night shift at Steak and Shake. So for all you Midwesterners out there, 11 to 7 at Steak and Shake. And nobody wanted to be there. And, you know, after 1 a.m., there weren't any supervisors there. So it's just the peons and the cooks. And you know, it could get pretty catty. It could get pretty, you know, people are pretty grouchy and haven't had enough sleep. And he said, so here's what I did. I just worked with joy. I just did my job to the best of my ability, not because anyone was watching me. And at first, it was odd. And after a while, people started going, why are you doing that? And he said, well, then I got to talk to people. One of the things we talk about here at the Institute is God's design for work. It's not part of the curse. It's part of God's design. It's something that he created. And so on a philosophical level, he got to share, I work because I'm working for God, not for anyone around here. And then after a while, he was building relationships. And he said, when I left there at the end of that semester, you know, now when I go back, it's hugs and it's people being really happy to see me. He said also by the end of that semester, I'd had the chance to share my testimony with almost every person in the place because they saw by the power of my life that there was something different there. And that was his chance to be winsome, to share truth in a way that was attractive to other people.
Mm-hmm. And what's huge there is he wasn't focused on winning.
Right. No.
It wasn't I'm going to go out and I'm going to even win people to Christ. It mm-hmm. was I'm just going to work because God's told me to work. And I'm going to do it in such a way that glorifies him.
Right.
And in the midst of that, God was glorified.
And the relationship was there.
Yes.
Yeah. He was loving people. He was sharing with them what God had done in his life. And he was doing it in a way that obviously was genuine because they received it.
Right. Well, and I think I just want to pause here and say, lest anyone think that this is not, you know, specifically what you guys are saying, specifically supported in Scripture, here are a few verses. 1 Peter 2:12, keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable so that when they speak against you as evildoers, mm-hmm. they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Matthew 5:16, in the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. 1 Peter 3:15, but in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. I think that is so true what you guys say. I mean, I just think of a friend of mine now who works at a hotel here in town, and just a great example. She was talking about trying to invite some friends we're going to do a game night at our place. And she said, I want to invite some of my coworkers, you know. And so she put this out there and kind of invited them. And they said, well, you know, we like you, you know, and we'd like to go. But, you know, you could just tell they were uncomfortable with that. And they just, their existence was not hanging out with friends in their homes, doing dinner, playing board games. And one of them said, you know, I don't know if we want to do that, but Karen just broke up with her boyfriend and we were all going to go to a strip club. So do you want to join us? And she was like, certainly. Oh my word, this is what my peers are out doing on Friday and Saturday nights. If you're not in a bar or at a strip club, it's like they don't know what to do. And they're so hungry for relationship mm-hmm. and for someone to just come alongside them and want to spend time with them. And she said, I have an opportunity here to do that. And I think that's so true, what you guys are saying, like as you are living your life, what does that look like? Now, because this is going to intimidate some people because they're like, well, I just don't know how to relate to people, or I'm an introvert and some people are just so winsome and I'm just not, and I'm just weird and I'm awkward anyway, even around people I know. So how do you be yourself and yet still be able, because we're all going to talk about, oh, that's just for the extroverts, or some people can do that and some people can't, but how can each individual person use the gifts that God has given them to speak into their culture right where they are?
You know, when I was working at my first church in Dallas, we did a spiritual gifts test. I remember one of them is the gift of evangelism. And there were some people in there didn't have the gift of evangelism. And they think that that gets them off the hook mm-hmm. from being able to talk about Jesus and love people the way that they're supposed to. I think if you look at a true perspective on all the spiritual gifts, they're all to be used for the glory of God. And they're all to be shared with the community that God's put you in, whether it's evangelism or whether it's works or whatever it looks like. It's supposed to be in the context of community for the glory of God. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to be the best extrovert. You don't have to be the most intelligent conversationalist. You just have to love people the way that Jesus does. Mm-hmm. And God will be glorified in the midst of that.
Okay, let me tell you an introvert story, too, because I have one of those on my mind. And it goes back a little bit to what Neelan said earlier about you have to do the inreach before you do the outreach. If you have been deeply transformed by the truth of the gospel, regardless of your personality, regardless of the spiritual gifts you've been given, then you have something to give. And so we had a student, summer of 2011, who was a teacher. She'd already been through her first year of teaching, so little side note, teachers, come spend the summer with us. She had had a rough first year of teaching and just hard public school culture. She's an elementary teacher. And so not that she's got, you know, gang members and stuff in her classroom, but it was a hard staff culture. A lot of cattiness going on, not a lot of real strong leadership. And it had just about worn her out. And so she came here and I think she was expecting to really grow academically, as far as knowing what she believed and why she believed it. And that did happen. But I think the larger work that was done was that in reach and looking at who am I? What's my identity in Christ? And she left here with just a much more settled realization of this is who I am. And I can be confident in my identity in Christ, and I don't have to strive so hard, and I don't have to do it all in my own effort, and I don't have to get worn out with my trying so hard. And so the first thing that happened is she went back to her school, and she's got other teachers going, wow, you're different. And she said, yeah, I know who I am. I have a sense of being loved. I have a sense of being fully accepted by Christ, and that's what I'm founded on now. And then the other thing that she was able to do is she went back with just some real communications tools. So to go back to there's a transformation and then there's a communication piece. And she started trying to implement in just very subtle ways. What if we could deal with the issues at hand instead of avoiding conflict? What if we can raise, you know, some of these things that are really undermining our staff culture? And she's not in a position of leadership officially, so she's got to do that in a way that's very humble and staying in her place under the authority of her principal. But she's starting to just introduce these communication principles. What if we can deal with these things? What if we can work together to problem solve instead of fighting against one another? And in very subtle ways, not only is that changing her school culture, but it's also changing her attitude toward her job. She's able to kind of hang in there instead of feeling like, man, I just can't do this, or I'm being beat down by this.
I think that gets back exactly to what Neelan was saying on the front end of the show here, and that is that we so underestimate the power of Christ in us.
Yes.
And I think of Romans 1:16, you know, I am not ashamed of the gospel. Why? Not because it's cleverly packaged, not because I'm super witty in presenting it, not because I just think that I can tie it up with a bow, but because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. And I think exactly what you're saying, Lindy, is so true, that you could work in Starbucks and just in a conversation with someone mention that you are not sleeping with your girlfriend. That's crazy talk. Mm-hmm. I mean, just by that alone is going to start a conversation because it is so countercultural. And you know what? Okay, if you don't want to talk about sleeping with your girlfriend, don't do, you know, while you're making a macchiato, don't do it. But use that opportunity to then continue the conversation when you can and as the Lord presents.
And I think Romans 1:16 is perfect because it's a declaration that the gospel of Jesus Christ is the power, I say, unto salvation, because I grew up with the King James, to everyone
we'll
that believes.
That one.
Yes. but so the first step is actually believing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's saying, I believe this. I internalize this. This is truth. Paul could declare it because Paul believed it. And here's one of the biggest hindrances I see amongst us as Christian believers. The world believes what the world says. Hmm. We question what we say. as it comes out of our mouth. So we add disclaimers to it. We add this, that, and the other to it. And by the time we get done, we've watered down the gospel because it doesn't sound like anything powerful anymore. It sounds like you're practicing apologetics while you're making the statement. So if it is the power to salvation, if it is the power unto salvation, then I think that the next lesson is, the next big point here is, as I read through scripture, I never see God call on anyone to utilize a gift that he hasn't first given to them. I can speak in front of large crowds of people. I'm completely comfortable. When the crowds get a whole lot smaller, I get very nervous. My wife is very good one-on-one with folks. But when the crowd gets large, she gets nervous. This is what I've noticed over our years of marriage. God tends to put Neelan Brown in front of large crowds, and he puts Tara Brown in front of small groups. Does that make sense? God calls out the gift that's already there because God is not lost. God doesn't think we're all going to go and become, you know, some great evangelist crusading from nation to nation. There may already be someone doing that, but here's the question. In your office space next to the copier, when someone shares a problem with you, are you willing to step up then? Because that may be the moment that God is calling you to. But in that moment, the moral of the story is, do you believe?
Right.
Romans 1 and 16.
And to do it in the unique way that God has gifted you and equipped you with your own personality.
Exactly.
I know for me, for example, I am not the person that is going to sit down with someone necessarily with a box of Kleenex, holding a kitten in my arms, and sit there and emote about every single thing that they're talking about. I, on the other hand, am the person who's going to go, I'm very black and white. I'm very tell it like it is. But I will, I mean, I'm the one who told my friend that she asked me if I thought she was going to hell. And I said, yeah, based on what you've told me. Yeah, I do. But here's what I also believe. I love you. I'm your friend. I want to talk about this. I want, you know, I want to know where you're struggling with this. And so I kind of come out of the gates, put everything on the table, and then I backfill with love, with humor, with relationship and stuff. And that's just my style, you know. Yeah. So I think we've got to understand that God uses all the uniquenesses of us in order to do what he's called us to do boldly and, like you said, winsomely. I think it's so true. So, well, you guys, we have to wrap up, but I want to just thank all three of you for representing this. And of course, you guys are really in the fray as you deal with university students every semester there at the Institute. For those of you out there, you should know this, but I'm going to tell you again, and please pass this on to your friends, focusleadership.org, an awesome, awesome program. Go to the site and find out more about it, how you can get involved, how you can tell your friends, those who are in college and considering something like this. We want to make sure that they know about it because it's just an awesome foundation and also just a supplement to what is happening within your own church community, within your own group of friends, whether or not you're in a campus ministry. Those are all awesome. And this is just another way to really ground yourself in the faith and beyond. So thanks to all three of you for being part of this conversation.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks for inviting us.
This is the time, the sound of salvation ringing to overcome, lift us from the wreckage. So live out loud, live out the song we are singing to the broken captive, to the weak and restless. For such a time as this, as we lift our voices,
hey everyone, for this week's culture segment, I am very privileged to have back in the studio in the flesh, Tim Gegline. Tim, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
Well, you've officially graduated. Well, you've done one other culture segment with us, but you were on a roundtable.
Yes,
as
indeed.
Well.
That's
so
right.
This is your third visit, your third interview with us.
So. And as I understand, Lisa, the third time is a charm. So at least this time, I hope to get it right.
Well, no, you contributed well in the previous times. And I will tell people to go and search Tim's name on our site and you can find some of the things he talked about previously. I just jokingly told him before we started recording here that we're going to be talking about elements of his life. So hopefully he prepared and studied ahead of time so he knows what to talk about here. But many of you know, if you listen to the show and if you're familiar with Focus on the Family, that Tim is now our Vice President of External Relations here at Focus, which means that he basically hangs out in Washington, D.C. and hobnobs with important people and represents Focus to them, which is kind of a reciprocal job from what you had previously. You did the former.
Exactly. For those who don't know, I have written a memoir called The Man in the Middle, and the subtitle is An Inside Account of Faith and Politics in the George W. Bush Era. And the reason I say that, Lisa, is because in the nearly 8 years that I was working with and for President Bush, I was offered a very long title, which was a special assistant to the president and the deputy director of the White House Office of Public Liaison. And when Karl Rove, who wrote the foreword to the book, offered that position to me in behalf of the president, I said, can you translate that into the English language? And he said, it means you'll be the man in the middle. You will be the president's point man to your fellow Christians and conservatives. And I say that because in a way that I never would have expected or anticipated, you're right. That kind of model is very close to what I do with and for Focus on the Family in Washington. I'm Focus's eyes and ears in Washington and our ambassador to the most powerful city in the world.
Yeah. And I love how you jokingly say in the book that the longer the title you had in Washington, the less influence you had.
Yes,
so I guess
yes.
President, you're pretty important. You know,
Senator,
if you have to explain
Congressman, exactly. Justice, yes, exactly.
Oh, well, you know, I was in D.C. as well. I was there at the Washington Times, and I can't even remember what my title was. So I'm sure that's not the best.
It shows how powerful you actually were.
That must have been it. That must have been it. As I was shuffling papers and sending emails. So, okay, this is an interesting journey that we're going to be talking about, and you did reference the book. And I want to start out, Tim, by talking about you growing up, because you talk about being a product of the 70s and 80s, but as I was reading your story, when most of us were playing Pac-Man and watching MTV, you were basically reading the Constitution and the Federalist Papers, and you were getting into all elements of culture. And I'm going to be honest, that's just kind of weird.
I can honestly say that I was and am a nerd. And in fact, as I recount in the book, I was born in 1964, which is the last year of the baby boom. And I remember very clearly on most summer evenings when I'd be playing in the backyard, my mother or father would call me just before 5:30 and tell me to come in because Walter Cronkite was on. And I'd go in and watch the CBS Evening News. The reason I'm saying that, and presumably the reason you asked me, is because when I was young and when I was growing up in the Midwest, there does come that moment. And I think it's true for most children, even the ones who don't come in to watch Walter Cronkite, but who stay and play kickball and baseball and whatever. But elementally, there's all kinds of things that are forming who you are and what you're interested in. And I'm quite certain that I couldn't have said as a young boy, what I'm interested in is that matrix of where policy, politics, and the press overlap. Even though I couldn't have said it then, I think all of the foundations or antecedents, as they say, were coming together. And as I was growing up, those are the things, current events, what was in the news, history, culture, the arts, politics, those things were important to me. Although I will say this, I always loved baseball and tennis. And I don't know if most nerds do, but I certainly did and do with a passion.
Yeah. Well, and it's so interesting because you were starting to follow just culture and politics and all that, growing up in Indiana. I mean, it's not like you were a Kennedy. It's not like you had, you walked the halls of all these people that had served in different offices or whatever. So it really was something born out of what you believed. You know, you kind of probably had an inkling of who we were as a nation just by observing your family and just honest, hardworking people and understanding that a lot of those ideals were something that probably were part and parcel of something bigger than themselves.
Yes. I was very fortunate to grow up in a home where there was never a single second of a doubt that my mother and father were crazy about one another. That really helps as a little person. Mm-hmm. My father, who is my best friend, as I recount in my book, next to my wife, was entrepreneurial, business-oriented, a small businessman, self-made. My mother, like my father, never went to college until many years later. She went back to college, as I recount in the book. But my mother, I hate to say that she was intellectually curious, because that sounds like she was elevated. She wasn't. But my mother is the one who introduced me to classical music, introduced me to jazz, who introduced me to really good novels, who taught me to be really curious about things worth being curious about. My father always loved history. My father loved animals. My father loved sports. So, you know, when you're a little person and you're absorbing all this, you know, you're being shaped and formed in a certain way. But you're right. For most of the kids that I grew up with in a decidedly middle-class part of the middle of America, most people were not overwhelmingly interested in many of the things that were becoming interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty fun. Well, I think it's just, it's a fascinating story, and folks are going to have to get the book to get the full account of this. But basically, in a nutshell, you were offered an internship, basically with Dan Quayle. You did that for a summer, the kind of your third taste of Washington, D.C. You'd gone once as a family and then once with school, but you were back now and you were officially going to live there for a summer and be part of it. Then you returned actually on staff, or you had the opportunity to go work for Dan Coats, and you did that. And really, that was a very defining, you define him or describe him as one of really your most influential people and a great friend, someone that has really influenced you. And then a season with Dan Coats, a long season, and then you were on Gary Bauer's campaign. We all know Gary Bauer here at Focus on the Family through his work with the Family Research Council. And all of a sudden, you find yourself on the campaign of this guy named George W. Bush. Now, had you anticipated this? I mean, I know you didn't anticipate that first internship, but was this something that you felt was snowballing, Tim? And you just, because I know you wanted, you really were interested in broadcast journalism, and it's kind of like you never quite, you would try to pull yourself into it and you'd get pulled out back over to D.C. So what really defines kind of that era of your life?
What defined that era was actually going to Washington two summers, as you describe, as an intern. And for the first time, meeting all the other nerds. Some were liberal, some were Democrats, some were conservative, some were Republicans. I met a lot of people who loved art and music and who loved tennis like me. And I realized that I was meeting this whole group of people who eventually wanted to work in journalism, who wanted to work in public policy, who wanted to work in think tanks, who weren't embarrassed when you said, what's your opinion of World War II or the Civil War, or, you know, did Abraham Lincoln win the Lincoln-Douglas debates, you know? And as a young man, that was very exciting to me. But as you describe, after 10 years in the Senate, working for Dan Coats, after working for Gary Bauer, I decided by and large that I was mostly done with politics. And I went to see Dan Coats, and he said, you're making a big mistake. You really should work on at least one presidential campaign. And I worked on Gary Bauer's campaign. And after Gary flamed out, after doing a great job, a really great job through all those debates in 2000, to answer specifically your question, I was at the Philadelphia convention when George W. Bush was formally nominated. I saw Karen Hughes in an elevator by happenstance. And she said to me, I think we want to get you on board. And I had no idea what she was talking about. And within a few weeks, her deputy called me. And within 2 weeks after that, my wife and I and our two boys were driving in our Dodge Caravan to Austin, Texas. We joined the Bush for President campaign. I was 32 days in Florida during Bush versus Gore. We won. I thought I was going to be offered a job in the White House press office. And out of a clear blue sky, Karl Rove called me. And as I recount in the book, he said, Tim, I'm calling to change your life. Hmm. And he did.
And he did. And I love one thing that you share in the book is just kind of that anticlimactic season of the Florida ballot count. And you were sitting there in Florida and you felt, you know, at first it was, you know, Gore called and conceded and then he retracted. And then you're just sitting there and you're like, there wasn't really any fanfare because everyone had to go to bed and no one knew what was decided. And you said you actually describe going to Epcot in that season and really having a jolt of what it felt like to be among real people who weren't obsessed with hanging chads and everything else that was going on.
I'm actually really glad you asked that question because in this book, I wanted to give sort of a series of snapshots of what these things actually felt like. And only one time in 32 days in Florida, being in nine different cities, only one time did we have half a day off. And we went to Epcot. And I remember being at Epcot on this beautiful day, watching families walk around together. And you know, Lisa, at this point, I had not seen my family in several weeks. And I thought, my gosh, why are they not as obsessed, you know, with this with this election as everybody else is? And mm-hmm. I realized, no, normality actually now was residing in a different spot. And of course, we were exhausted. A big night of sleep was 3 hours.
Yeah. And I really love, Tim, how you describe, there's a section of the book where you're talking about just feeling a little disillusioned with that and feeling like, I think your folks were in Pennsylvania celebrating Thanksgiving and your family was in Texas and here you were in Florida. And you said your dad talked to you on the phone and he said, "Remember, Tim, there's a purpose in all of this. We are praying for you. Don't lose your optimism. It will all work out. Be thankful to God for this. He will give you peace." And then you describe later on in the paragraph, you say, "Carpe diem for me was to be Christ-centered despite the outcome."
Yes.
And I see that as so such an interesting point to make, especially to an audience of young adults who feel like a lot of times we're caught up in the churn, whether we're in a job we don't like, whether we feel like we wish we would have planned something else, but here we are doing this, or feeling disillusioned about our upbringing versus where we are now. Mm. And did you see that? I mean, because you were, you know, young, I mean, you know, young dad with two kids, as far as just feeling like that giving you a sense of, okay, I can move forward from here?
Two comments. First, your question is very perceptive. Point one, I never thought I would be near to 40 years old or my late 30s needing the validation and help of my dad. Hmm. But I did. Mm-hmm. I really felt despair. As you know from the description of the book, to cheer us up on Thanksgiving Day, they brought in Wayne Newton, you know, and nobody in the room knew who Wayne Newton was.
Yeah.
And then he sang his quote-unquote signature song and promptly forgot the words, and I thought, I'm out of here, you know. And I go back to my hotel room feeling this great sense of despair. And in the Christian life, despair is a sin. Mm-hmm. And my father reminded me of that. And I frankly, after that phone call, which was really pivotal, I never felt it again. I felt that win, lose, or draw, this is where I'm supposed to be. And it really impacted my life in a very significant way. The second comment is the famous novelist Virginia Woolf famously turned, she was British, and she turned to a young Brit, and she once said, "What does it feel like to be young?" You know, and this goes to the heart of your question. I know I'm talking to thousands of people who have a difficult time, as we all do, but particularly when you're young, these are very large questions, and you're trying to figure it all out. And sometimes you need the reality check of one other person, presumably a Christian, who can help say, just remember, first principles exist, God is sovereign, He's in charge, and all shall be well. And sometimes we just need to hear that from one other person.
Yeah, okay. So you mentioned here that Karl Rove gave you a call and basically asked you a question that changed your life. That question led to you actually having a full-time position in the George W. Bush White House. And I just want to focus on that era for a little bit here, because really much of the focus of this book is you talking about President Bush as we, many of us, did not know him. What we knew came off of whether it was CNN or Fox News or the networks, you know, trying to get bits and pieces, glimpses here. But you walked into an office every day and basically dealt with things that he was ordering directly. So, and one of the pivotal moments of that on the front end of his presidency was 9/11. And you devote a chapter to that and really what happened there. And really in the wake of that, describe Bush's presidency as a war presidency. And you say no president, except possibly Teddy Roosevelt, wanted to be considered a war president.
That's right.
How do you think that really shaped President Bush going in and really a year later recognizing, oh my word, here I am, and this is probably going to define where I go from here?
You know, Lisa, if you go back to the first inaugural address that President Bush delivered, he's one of the few presidents ever to put the centerpiece of a speech in a parable, which he does in the parable of the Good Samaritan. And if you read that speech as I have, it's really a beautiful speech. It's really a peace and prosperity speech. You know, a two-term Texas governor is coming to Washington following the difficulties of the Clinton-Gore presidency. And it's really quite a idyllic description. within a year, as you say, and I write about this in a chapter called Lightning Out of a Clear Blue Sky, which is the Pearl Harbor of our generation, 9/11. I was in the White House that day. And to answer your question, Lisa, very directly, I watched a Peace and Prosperity two-term governor become a war president. That was a remarkable thing to watch. I'm quite certain in my professional life, you know, short of scaling Mount McKinley or something, I'll never see anything like that again. It was really a remarkable thing. Because I was Karl Rove's deputy, I spent a lot of time at close range with the president. I prayed with the president. I got to know him. And I got to see him, what he was like when, you know, the doors were closed and the lights were off and the cameras were not worrying for the next news conference, you know. And I found two things. I found that George W. Bush was the same in private as he is in public. That's very rare in Washington. And one of the things that I love about George W. Bush. Also, and most importantly, and this is, I think, the most important thing I can say on Boundless, George W. Bush's presidency cannot be understood separate from his Christianity. I believe that the revisionist history, in the best sense, is just starting in the Bush presidency, because we have now the benefit of time and a little distance. And my book is the first book to be written, not as a biography, not as a history, but as a political memoir, because I came to see that if you are someone like Karl Rove or Condi Rice or Don Rumsfeld or you know, the vice president, Dick Cheney, who've all written memoirs, you're so close to the power that you don't see things. But those of us like me who were not the senior most people, we were not the confidants. We had a bit of a distance, but we still saw a lot of things. So I wanted to take people into the Oval Office, onto Air Force One. I wanted them to, you know, come along on the South Lawn for big things that we had to do. And in the 9/14 service at the National Cathedral, actually be there for how that service came together. But all from a perspective of the biggest thing that George W. Bush and I share in common, mm-hmm. which is our love for Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. And I know that throughout the book, especially when you're detailing your time in the White House, you talk about how it was really his intent to constantly bring back his faith-based agenda. And even though people tried to define him in other ways and people tried to constantly hinge on this or that policy or get back to 9/11, you know, he would always mention it first or second as really one of his primary priorities. When we look, Tim, you know, we'll often try to define presidents by a few things, you know, and, you know, taking Reagan as an example, we think of the Berlin Wall, we think of Challenger, we think of taxes. What would you say, you know, in giving, if you were introducing President George W. Bush and mm-hmm. you could define his presidency by a few things, what would you say they are? And probably overlook things mm-hmm. in some ways.
Several things. I take the reader back to the first major Iowa debates when all the candidates were asked, and I was there that night, who's your favorite philosopher? And he said, Jesus Christ, because he changed my life. That is a defining moment for George W. Bush. It was his way of saying, I'm not afraid to let people know that Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior. I was really touched by that when that happened, and I think millions of people were. By the way, in the room where I was watching the debate in Iowa, there was an audible gasp. I think that when he ascended the pulpit at National Cathedral on the same day as Billy Graham, and he spoke about the exceptional, exemplary nature of the United States and our role as the beacons of freedom, I think his passion for the innocent preborn. You know, George W. Bush always said the line that Father Newhouse famously said, that eventually America would be a place where every child would be welcomed into the world and protected by the law. That's the ultimate pro-life statement from a president. George W. Bush will be remembered as the most pro-life, pro-marriage, pro-family, pro-religious liberty, individual conscience president of any of the contemporary presidencies. And it wasn't just words, it was actions. It was elevating to the highest court in the United States justices who share the president's view. And this is very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, a day in the life of the president. What did that look like when there weren't wars to worry about and there wasn't craziness and there wasn't speech? You know, obviously, probably every day had a speech. But what did he do from day to day for the most part, as you saw?
He began every single day early. He's an early riser. He began his day with the First Lady because they knew that if they didn't have time together in the morning, the day would be disparate. So I love the fact that they would have breakfast together, have coffee together, etc. But every single day for George W. Bush began with reading his Bible, reading devotions, and in prayer. And I took great heart from that. Hmm. But frankly, every single day when you're president of the United States, for all the order that a very talented staff seeks to impose in your life. And George W. Bush is a person who likes order. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's never late. He's always early or exactly on time. He's very mindful of other people. If he meets a pope, a queen, a king, a president, a prime minister, or he meets the man or woman on the street or a junior staffer, he's a person of great magnanimity, and everybody is the same in his eyes. That, I think, also springs from his faith. But for George W. Bush, it was, to use his Texas phrase, getting at it. It was a very busy day of travel, of speeches, of major decisions, every single day, 7 days a week. There's never a day when you're the president that the most important things, the most important, do not come across your desk. And the thing that I'm very eager to leave with the boundless listener is the following, that it is a dispiriting, difficult reality that when you're the president of the United States, you learn often of all the people and all the schemes and all the tactics and all the strategies who, if these so-called people had the ability, would push the proverbial button and blow us to kingdom come. And what you learn when you're at the White House is that the terrorists or the people who mean us harm, they can make lots of mistakes. But when you're the leader of the free world, when you are the president of the United States, your first obligation is the safety of the people. And so I think that every single day of George W. Bush's presidency, particularly after 9/11, was preventing another attack on our domestic soil. And I think overwhelmingly, that's the greatest achievement of the Bush presidency. This, by the way, I think will grow over time.
Hmm. And in what way, Tim, do you think he was most misunderstood? I mean, did he even follow all the comedians that lampooned him? I mean, our generation, it's like it's hard to even think of President Bush without thinking of Will Ferrell or without thinking mm-hmm. of... So yeah. All the crazy things that were said about him, what was most misunderstood?
Well, he is a person of great humor. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, mostly he was, as you well know from his public comments, he was good about laughing at himself. Mm-hmm. You know, in this, he shared this in common with Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And he has President Bush has a great sense of humor. And so does the First Lady, former First Lady, who, by the way, is a person of great elegance, panache. I think she's a really a remarkable person. But yes, the president does pay attention. But there's a difference between a president who pays attention and a president who's preoccupied. And the president was not preoccupied by what other people said or thought. He was willing, and I think that this redounds to his benefit, he was willing to be unpopular because he had to make decisions that were unpopular. When you're organizing 22 agencies of the federal government in the biggest reorganization since World War II, you step on a lot of toes. You don't intend to do that, but ultimately that's what you do. And I believe that it's true that George W. Bush in the contemporary presidency left the presidency unpopular. But I think he left the presidency unpopular, rooted in principle, not because of his decision-making capacities, which I think is very high and I think grows over time.
I am a candle in the night. I'll throw my fists and I'll fight when the wind throws the night at the wick. Shelter in the cold. No amount of rain could erode this foundation of stone. I will hold. These walls. And I
All right. Well, we are opening up this week's inbox, and I have Glenn Stanton in the studio. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. Good to have you. Thanks for weighing in on our blog recently.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Very good stuff.
So. Actually, I'm kind of behind in some of my responses, so some people may think I'm being rude, but
I know.
Well, not.
Sometimes you just like to give that impression.
You can use it to your advantage.
It's just, you should maybe listen to our roundtable this week on being winsome.
Okay.
To maybe get a few tips there. That'll be good.
I could use that little edge.
Good stuff. Well, you're going to answer a question here from one of our listeners, and she says, I am a grad student at a large state university. My question is how to approach the topic of gay marriage so people don't assume I'm anti-gay. How would you suggest communicating a pro-marriage idea without making it seem that we want people that are gay to be unhappy?
That's a great, great question. I love her spirit. Mm-hmm. I deal with this issue a lot. I do a lot of lectures on college campuses on this very topic. And first of all is the kind of bad news. I mean, one, unfortunately with this issue, it is absolutely equated that if you do not embrace same-sex marriage, that somehow, you know, the only option is, well, you must hate gay people. And I think it's important for students to really push against that. I think, first of all, it's very, very important for all students to, first of all, make sure that you have gay friends. And that's not just to go out and make friends as kind of what I call as gospel projects, but really develop real meaningful relationships with gay and lesbian students on campus so that as you go to make the case, they can't say, well, you know, you hate gay people. Look, you know what? I'm genuine friends with people. We don't agree. We don't see things exactly the same way. And really challenge this idea that somehow to disagree means to hate. We don't do that in any other area of life. Think about veganism. You know, does anybody go, well, because you don't buy into veganism, you must hate me? I mean, that's just ludicrous. Mm-hmm. It's really only on the gay question that we so personalize it, that just because I can't embrace your position means that somehow I don't like you. I mean, students really need to stand up against that. And the first way to stand up against it is to actually be caring friends with people who are gay and lesbian. I think it informs your own faith. It informs your own position. Not to be persuaded that everything's hunky-dory and fine with that, but to understand from their position why they are like they are. And then do your homework and study. You know, find good Christian thinkers on these issues. Stanton Jones at Wheaton, Mark Yarhouse at Regent. I mean, there's a number of great people who have written good stuff on the homosexual condition, and read that kind of stuff, know that stuff, and contribute in class in a thoughtful way, not just a reactionary kind of way or pulling out chapter and verse from the Bible, but talking about why you actually believe what you believe. And what you'll find is that most of your opponents will not be as well-read or as thoughtful as you are. I mean, they're working off of cheap sound bites. Just make sure that you're not offering cheap sound bites from your side. Really study and really know what it is you're talking about. We provide a lot of those materials and resources here at Focus on many of our different websites. People can find articles that make the case for why same-sex marriage is not a good idea.
Yeah. I think too often, it's exactly what you said, too often we're so fearful to find anything good in a person who may self-identify as gay. You know, and it's either because we have been fearful in establishing relationships, so we're just going to rely on this caricature, or we just don't know how to address them as people and how to love them as people. Okay. I mean, I have a number of gay and lesbian friends, and I love to affirm them in the fact that they are great friends, they are great workers, they are great parents, some of them. They are, you know, and what they do, they do well, and I just love their friendship. And then with that, I can say, you know what? Here's something that we don't agree on, and here's something, you know, and we've talked about it many, many times, but then you circle the wagons and get back to, but you're my friend, and you're, and to recognize, Glenn, and I think a lot of people underestimate this, is that there is very, I mean, the Holy Spirit has to change hearts. The Holy Spirit has to change lives. We're not going to sit here and give our gay friends 4 points about why they should do dot, 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 dot. You know, without the power of the gospel in someone's life, people live in blindness, whether it's related to, you know, gay marriage, whether it's related to sexuality, whether it's related to addictions, whether, you know, we're trapped in our sin until Jesus sets us free.
It's interesting. I mean, one of the points that I make in my debates when I get this, oh, you just hate us kind of point of view is say, listen, I have the same position on same-sex marriage that Barack Obama has. I mean, he says that he's evolving, but he hasn't stated any position different than what he has stated is that he is against it. Then ask the question, does Barack Obama hold the position that he holds because he hates gay people? No, there are reasonable people that hold an alternative position to you that clearly you know they don't hate. So don't just stick that on me, you know, just because I'm a religious conservative that somehow I must hate. I mean, that's lazy kind of intellectualism. And sort of push back on them and find other people that basically hold your position that are kind of outside the box of the religious conservative reactionary and say, you know what, basically that's my position. And I think that's very important to do. But I think that's the thing is you got to push back and just say, you know what, don't put that label on me unless I give you reason to think that I'm hateful and that I'm mean. There are plenty of Christians that unfortunately act like that. But you know what, just don't sign me up for that just because you think I'm different than you are.
Mm-hmm. Well, good thoughts, Glenn, and thank you for weighing in on that. Again, we want to hear from you. Write to us at editor@boundless.org if you have a question for a future show, and make sure that you are catching up on current shows and past shows so that you know kind of what we've addressed in the past. And if there's a question maybe that answers something that you may be wondering about, let us know about that as well. Well, Martha and I right now are at the Give Me an Answer Radical Conference in Louisville, Kentucky. If you are there, you better be stopping by our booth to say hello, because we want to talk to you and say hello. And I think what we're doing there greatly fits into the theme of this show as well, to be passionate about the gospel, excited about the gospel, and knowledgeable about the gospel and applying it to everyday life. So we hope that you are in that journey with us. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org, focused on the family.